made up nano Brillo pads next. I don't know. Back to net.
Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. If you have any questions of a technical nature or topics you want discussed, or you want to discuss the COVID-19, any aspects of it, I will try my best to give you information that's useful. So this is an opportunity for that if you are interested in such. Okay, let's play a little round of science talk. I'm not going to read you a whole bunch of articles. I have one that I find particularly amusing, so I will share it with you, and it'll be a nice thing to be presented right before Paul's space report. There was some discussion a couple of weeks ago about the sounds of outer space. Unfortunately, since sound does travel in a medium and outer space is a vacuum, there isn't that much in the way of sounds out there in outer space. And yet, NASA seems to be promoting the interesting notion that the vacuum of space has its own particular smell. And for a nominal fee, you can have that odor permeating your nostrils very soon. According to these people, one thing most of us Earthlings may not realize is that outer space smells, apparently. Reportedly, over a decade ago, NASA chemists developed a scent that mimics the, quote, smell of space, end quote, to give astronauts a whiff of the cosmos before they left Earth's atmosphere. Now, the company, Eau de Space, has gotten its hands on that scent, and you can order a bottle or 10 through Kickstarter. In a video shared by Eau de Space, a NASA astronaut, Tony Antonelli, says that space smells strong and unique, unlike anything we have ever smelled on Earth. According to Eau de Space, others have described the smell as seared steak, raspberry, and rum, smoky and bitter. Let me drop for a sec. NASA has reportedly been working on the scent for over a decade, but it was trapped behind red tape and bureaucracy. So Eau de Space team got its hands on the recipe thanks to determination, grit, and a lot of luck, and a couple of Freedom of Information Act requests. So this is the first time the public will have a chance to experience that smell. At $29 pledge, you will get one bottle of Eau de Space, and the company will donate a bottle to a K-12 STEM program, for whatever reason. There are slight discounts if you buy in bulk, and for each bottle you purchase, Eau de Space will donate one. Eau de Space does not have plans to mass produce the scent after the Kickstarter campaign, so if you're thinking about pledging, don't wait too long. So my best guess is people peddling this have either been sniffing Eau de Space way too long or stacks of $100 bills. I would suggest they sniff some good old oxygen or business ethics textbook instead. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
I've checked my calendar. It's not April.
Yes, indeed. If I saw this around April, this would be my go-to story. This is actually legit, apparently. It only goes to show that we live in a weird, weird world. I think the actual thing that's going on is that astronauts tend to live in crafts. The crafts are filled with chemicals and ozone-creating devices and lubricant oils, and so Eau de Space is basically Eau de Spaceship, but it sounds much better to call it Eau de Space. Supposedly, this is real. I leave it to the audience to Google it and see if they can find the Kickstarter page.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You said it's, at one point you said it smelled like smoke. So my guess is they got this, you know, they created this whole story based around the original landing on a moon when Armstrong and Aldrin came back into the command module, Columbia. You had and Mike Collins, and you said, you guys are a mess. You make sure you clean all, all the stuff off your spacesuit. You're not coming into my spaceship. You know, he was up there by himself the whole time. And he was a command module pilot, which they did. But they noticed when they took all the, when they were brushing things off, they took their helmets off. They even noticed it on the moon, too, when they took their helmets off back in the land, that it had a smell of gunpowder type. It's the regolith. It's the dust that's on the lunar surface. So maybe somebody read that story, and maybe they decided to run with it. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, look, it's the free enterprise system. I understand. If people want that sitting around someplace, and, so be it. I mean, as a joke gift, maybe it makes some sense. I don't know. At least, $29, even for a joke, it's not a terribly overpriced joke. I just thought it was an amusing story to share with the rest of you guys. Anyway, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the TechNet, the Limar Technical Net that's here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. Let me remind you of a couple of places to go and look things up. If you want to send me a question or a topic, or you have a puzzle that you've solved and you want to challenge me, or just give it to me so I can challenge the rest of you guys out there, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder about a video, YouTube, web page, or some story, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to articles that I will be putting up. I already put up two articles. I'll probably put up a few more before the TechNet is over. You can find them at roy.ac2gs.com. And the chat room is alive and quiet. The audio stream hopefully is running well at technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, MikeKC2NJI's amateurradio.tv has archives of the Technical Net going back to as far as September of 2006. And without further ado, let me pass the baton to Paul for the Space Report. WS2N with the Space Report. Paul, on to you.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Very interesting night so far, Roy. Okay, let me just start off with a topic I was talking about last week, about the Electron rocket that failed, that was launched out of New Zealand in North Island by a company called Rocket Lab. Peter Beck owns this company, registered company in the United States. Rocket engines are built here in the United States. Rockets themselves are built here, as well as New Zealand. And he launches small payloads to space, and he's been doing this for about a year and a half or so. And he's up to his 13th launch, and it failed last week. He actually launched on the 4th of July, and it did fail going into space. And at that time we had no idea what the problem is. Now it looks like they're starting to talk about these batteries. The Electron rocket runs on batteries instead of using the exhaust or the pre-burners that most rockets use to spin the turbines, which spin the pumps, which pumps the liquid oxygen, liquid kerosene into the rocket engines. They use these 50 horsepower motors backed up with these massive lithium ion batteries to do that. And he's got 9 engines on the first stage and 1 engine on the second stage. And the batteries have enough power to spin these things for a couple of minutes. First stage separates from the second stage, second stage is supposed to light up and push the payload to orbit. And I think it's within the second stage, according to the telemetry that's coming back. It's a possibility now. What they do is they're pretty big batteries. I'm not sure the weight of them, but they, like the final stage runs on three lithium batteries. And to lighten the weight further, when the first two batteries are done, they get ejected from the second stage, and then they run the rest of the trip on the third battery. I think something happened with the separation. Either something mechanically fouled up, or maybe electronically didn't switch over properly didn't do a handover to the other battery. Don't know. But it's something along that, you know, when I get a final answer, you know, I'm sure they'll print it up. They're pretty good with that type of thing. So he'll be able to straighten that mess out and maybe get back to his manifest. He's got a lot of things on that. He's got he's got a launch complex he built in Wallops Island, Virginia. And that launch complex has been there like since the late 1940s. And they launch other things there. They launch the Antares rocket for Northrop Grumman, which puts the Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. And Minotaur rockets, they're starting to launch their solid fueled rockets. And now Peter Beck comes along and built his Electron rocket launch complex also. And, you know, he's finished with it. And he expects to launch shortly, I guess, once he straightens this last particular problem that he's had. Let me drop it. Okay, I just wanted to talk about that. That's how we left off pretty much last week. There's a Long March vehicle. Long March 5 vehicle is going to be launched from China they actually have a couple of days from now on Thursday, and what it's going to have is an orbiter and a lander and a rover, and it's going to be heading to Mars. So it should get there maybe in the February time frame. But you know, they do plan on launching this thing from China, so we do have some competition. It'll be you know, their first success of launching and first of all getting an orbiter into Mars, and of course getting something down to the planet which actually has wheels on it. But that remains to be seen. They've tried before, and it didn't work out for them. Years ago, they used a Russian Proton rocket to launch, and the rocket never made it out of orbit, out of Earth orbit. So they're launching on their own heavy lift vehicle this Thursday. So it should be interesting to see if they make it. Now, that's China. Now, this Tuesday, there'll be another... launch from Japan, also going to Mars. So, you know, the reason all these Mars flights are going up now is because Mars and Earth are relatively close to one another now. And, you know, that will change by, let's say, the end of August. If they waited to the end of August, none of these rockets would make it there. The vehicle that's going to be launched this Tuesday is going to be launched by Japan on an H-2A rocket. Japan has two big rockets that they use. They have the H-2B and the H-2A. The H-2B is the one they use for the HTV, which is a very big cargo vehicle that they always launch to the International Space Station. They've done that 9 times so far. And then the H-2A is their other rocket. It looks
pretty much the same, but it's used for, you know, their scientific flights and military flights. So it's going to be also used for the United Arab Emirates. UAE has built a spacecraft called Hope, which they plan on orbiting Mars. So that'll be another country that successfully does that if they do succeed. So that'll be interesting to see if that makes it off the launch pad this Tuesday from Japan, from the Takashima launch complex. Before I go on, any questions, comments? This is WS2N. Another Mars mission, by the way, will be the end of. It's supposed to originally go off on the 17th, and then they deleted it, and then they gave it another date, and we're up to the 30th. And that is going to be Perseverance. That's a 2,200-pound vehicle that will land on Mars, hopefully. That NASA is launching on an Atlas HTB, an Atlas 5 rocket. And that will be on the end of the month. And if all goes well, after launching, the first stage will separate. Then the second stage is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, a Centaur rocket, which will, it's built by Rocketdyne. And that stage will send the crew stage along with the lander and the helicopter. Ingenuity is the name of the helicopter. So Perseverance and Ingenuity will take a ride with the crew stage all the way to Mars and get there on February 18th. Computers are set up where no matter when they launch, and they were supposed to launch, like I said, on the 17th, that it will arrive there at the same date, February 18th. And their window will be closing pretty much into August. I think they could go to mid-August, so hopefully there's good weather. Hopefully the coronavirus doesn't stop everything. They have the worst situation right now, I think, in Florida. I think it's a toss-up between Florida and Arizona. I think they had like 15,000 cases in one day. So hopefully it doesn't affect this launch, which there's been countless people have worked on this $2.5 billion project for the last 10 years. And so hopefully they get to at least see their rockets go up on TV. I'm sure they're not going to recommend that with the infection down there, everybody standing too close to one another to watch a rocket take off. But hopefully the Atlas V does it, and we'll see. This is WS2N. Okay, second EVA took place actually 2 weeks ago on the International Space Station. You have Chris Cassidy, he's the commander, and he's ham radio operator, KF5KTR, went outside with Bob Benkin, KE5GGX, two ham radio operators, did it again. For their second EVA together. First one was to set up and start removing and replacing these nickel hydrogen batteries that have been aging on the space station. They probably had 15-year lifespan, and some parts of the space station, you know, are up to 20 years. So they're replacing with these massive lithium-ion batteries. They successfully did that. There's another has to be done. So there's two more EVAs for these two guys to do by the end of this month. And I think early August or so, they'll be sending Bob Hurley and Doug Hurley and Bob Benkin back on the Dragon crew vehicle. Land in the Atlantic Ocean, which will be definitely will make the news, because that it made the news when they went up first time anybody launched from American soil since 2011, and now here they are on station for, well, they went up on May 30th, so it'll be, you know, over a month that they'll be up there, and then they'll return. Hopefully everything goes good. They've got this Piker X heat shield that they're going to be using to get through the atmosphere. Drogue chutes will come out, two drogue chutes, and then... hopefully they land successfully in the Atlantic Ocean, where SpaceX will have a ship ready to pick them up. Let me drop in for any questions. Okay, nothing heard. Is another one that I was kind of surprised to see. Let me see. This was a story about Israel. Israel is a small country, but they launched a rocket successfully, put looks like one of their military or spy satellites up from their own country. They've done it before. It's been a long time. Back in 2016, they launched a rocket, and they used something called the Shavit rocket. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Roy will probably correct me. But its translation is shooting star. Shavat, I guess. It's I have it here somewhere. Shavit. And it successfully launched. It's a solid fuel rocket. And then... successfully got their vehicle up. Interesting thing about Israel when they launch a rocket, they've done a couple of times, is all rockets that we launch, either from the United States or even Kodiak, Alaska, or we've even had sea launches, everything always goes east or either, you know, or at least north or south. But we favor to the east because of the way the Earth is turning. That gives you, for instance, down by the equator, almost 1,000 mile an hour head start. You need to get up to roughly 17,500 miles an hour to get into a low Earth orbit. Israel has a disadvantage. They have to launch due west. So you know where Israel is. You know where the Mediterranean Sea is. They launch toward the Mediterranean Sea. So if they come flying out of the sky, something goes wrong, it'll crash and, you know, it'll burn up in the Mediterranean Sea. But in fact, that's where their first booster actually winds up going. The second booster ignites and finishes taking them to orbit. So they actually have to have enough power, you know, to compensate for this. They don't have that 1,000-mile-an-hour spin that everybody else has. You know, if they went north, you know, they're going to go over Syria. That's not too good. They don't want to break up over Syria. Jordan, the same way. If they go due west, they're going to be going over Jordan's territory. They pretty much, I think, get along with Jordan now. But down south, if they go south, it's Giza and all that nonsense. So they have to go due west. Many years ago, they launched a satellite and they put it into orbit. And a piece of paint, they figured this out. They figured out a piece of paint came off the rocket that was in orbit. Now, this thing is, I've told this on this net many years ago before. I remember talking to K2RIW about this, but this paint, this fleck of paint, was going in one direction, and the space shuttle was going in the other direction, lower Earth orbit, you know, 250 miles up. And this piece of paint hit the windshield of the space shuttle and created like a, you know, a bullseye, like you hit in a car, and hit your windshield. And that, you know, that windshield's like 4 inches thick, so, you know, there's no problem, but it did create a little dent in it. It was just one little flake. As you're going 13,500 miles one way, 17,500 miles one way for one, you know, for the space shuttle, and then going completely in the opposite direction as flake of paint was going the same speed. So, you know, a combined speed, you know, over 30,000 miles an hour. And amazing what this one flake of paint did. Somehow they figured this out, that that's where it was from. Any questions or comments? WS to us. Okay, nothing heard. There's another launch that, you know, normally I pay attention to as many as I can. But there's another launch that it's just, you know, to me, another Progress cargo vehicle going up to the International Space Station. I'll be going up on the 23rd of this month. And they've literally sent like over 70 of these things to the International Space Station since it started. And Russia launches the Progress from a Soyuz vehicle. And Progress is like the cargo version of the Soyuz spacecraft. Kind of even looks the same. And it has the same docking mechanism and everything. And they could dock to any of the four ports that the Russians have on the back of the space station. So you could have, you know, two spacecraft, two manned spacecraft, and two cargo vehicles, any different combination you want on attached to the space station on the Russian side. So, you know, they always bring up either, you know, cargo for the crew, clothes, food. They'll bring up stuff for NASA if NASA needs something to go up. Or they'll bring up and they usually bring up some fuel. They'll attach it to the space station and they'll pour it into the tanks that the space station needs. Trust the capability of having to move out of the way for some reason or another, or translate, which change our locations, you know, it needs this fuel, hydrazine fuel. Sometimes they'll send up a Progress vehicle with mostly that, you know, fuel the space station. But the reason this one particular Progress rocket is very important, that's sending up a gadget to detect benzene. Apparently last April, benzene was detected on the International Space Station. They have this this gadget, this I'm trying to remember it was letters, but make a long story short, it's a gadget for detecting benzene, and they only have one of them on the space station. And last April they started noticing them, and they've gone through a couple of procedures of trying to track it down. They don't know where it's coming from. Now, benzene could be very dangerous, of course, over time. You know, you inhale it, you start winding up with problems. I think it could foul up your red blood cells or your white blood cells or both. And I'm dropping a second. So what happened with this machine? I think it was called AQM. It was an air quality machine, some kind of air quality monitor, and it failed eventually. I mean, they were trying different things. They were going to close the doors, some of the doors between the different sections. They were trying to figure out if it was from the Russian side or from the American side. But the numbers started to increase. But eventually this air quality machine failed. So they're sending up a brand new one on the Progress machine. And that's what I'm concerned about. These guys are floating around up there, five people right now, inhaling benzene with numbers that went above parts per million. In front of a stood by a gas station all day long, you know, you'd be getting some sense of benzene. Well, apparently the number here is higher than that. So, and they don't know why it's going up, they don't know where it's coming from. So, the only difference is I think hopefully they sent up two of these air quality monitors, case the other one failed. They figured out, you know, that they could not repair the old one in space. But hopefully they managed to straighten this out. They have the three Americans and two Russians up on board. And it'd be interesting to find out where this is coming from. You know, out of the clear blue sky, you know, all of a sudden there's benzene. I mean, benzene comes out of other materials, like comes out of fuels, and, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's part of the hydrazine component that the Progress vehicle normally brings up, recharges the space station. I don't know if hydrazine has that component in it. You know, it comes from other, comes from plants. So out of the clear blue sky, they have this benzene problem. One guy was thinking, well, maybe it came up with the Dragon vehicle that brought up Doug Hurley and Bob Spencken, but that was May 30th when they docked the space station. And these readings were getting higher and higher back in April and when it started. So hopefully they get this all worked out. I'm sure there'll be a report somewhere down the line. Any questions or comments? This is WSUN. Paul. Paul, this is AC2GS. Yes, Roy, go ahead.
Yeah, benzene is a ubiquitous organic solvent. It's called an aromatic. It's basically six carbon atoms arranged in an interesting chain where they share 1.5 bonds apiece. And it was all over the place. When I was a chemistry major, we had bottles of the stuff, and we were pouring it and spilling it all over the place before people realized that it gives you, as you mentioned, anemia. It diminishes your immune status, and it's a cancerous for liver cells. So it's a nasty thing. I don't think it's related to the hydrazine. Hydrazine is a N2H4 as opposed to a C6H6 type of molecule, but it's ubiquitous in all kinds of plastic and aromatic compounds. Toluene, a lot of petroleum products have benzene derivatives.
Okay, I know it's in smoke. People that smoke, sure it's not lethal, but you know, I think it caused problems over years. It's a quantitative thing. Probably like lead, right?
Well, yeah, the less the better. I mean, we're all exposed to a certain degree of benzene because things give it off, you know, plasticizers and other such. But you try and keep it to a minimum as best you can. And you don't want people to be in an enclosed area with, serious amounts. I wasn't able to really find out what the amount of benzene was detected, just that it was detected.
Hey, maybe somebody brought up that OD space smell product.
Well, that would be great for marketing.
$27. Put it in. Set it up on with Cassidy when he went up with the two Russians in a Progress vehicle. Yeah, boy, 2H for ID. Very good. So, yeah. Okay. Well, so much for that. Did you hear the part about the Shavit rocket from Israel? Were you listening to that?
Yes, I did. You pronounced it right, Shavit. I think it's Shavit 2. It loses something in the translation. One of the many words that are used as a descriptor for the word is comet, but I'm sure you could come up with a whole bunch of vaguely similar things, because The word probably goes back about 3,000 years.
Okay, you know, I got to get better with them. I was doing pretty good with the Russians, but now Israel's stepping into the game. They had the lander, it failed. Barashit, whatever. And that one failed. They got right very close to the moon. It was about to land, and it didn't work out last year. But they're not finished. They made their arrangements with an American company, and it's going to be called Genesis. So they're going to take their design. I don't think Israel's going to put any more money into it. This American company's going to get involved with it, and probably launch on a SpaceX vehicle, rocket. And they're going to try the same thing, except, you know, they're going to have improved computer on board to send the signals properly to the engine. They had flipped the thing around 180 degrees by mistake, you know, with the computer programming. When they flipped the engine, they thought it was slowing down. They speeded up and hit the moon at like 500 miles an hour. This other company's going to fix that, and Israel's going to be very happy to. They got somebody else to, they copied it, so, and they improved on it. They're going to improve on their thrusters as well. So, okay, any other comments or questions?
KBJM, that was an interesting comment on the space mail.
Okay, yeah, sure, go ahead. I think that's a good, I'm glad we brought that one up. Sometimes this stuff gets a little dry. That's a pretty good story. Back to you.
Let's see if I have it. Interesting about the space smell. They obviously, we all know that space is a vacuum. But for smell to exist, would there be some air to support the actual smell? Isn't a smell types of cells, molecules, combination of that? And it has to have a carrier of air. Over to whoever can answer that question for me there.
Of course, I agree. And Roy Boyle has said that originally. We started talking about that. The sound, that was another one that before this topic. You know, was there any sound in space? Of course there isn't. They haven't tested this actually in space yet, but there was a question about whether or not a gun would fire in space, and I've actually looked that up. You could actually fire a gun in a vacuum, you know, like a rifle or something. It would go off. They've actually tested that, you know. So at that point, if you collect the molecules coming off the gun, you know, then you could say, oh, yeah, there's that gunpowder smell. But, yeah, that's not going to happen. Paul?
Paul Zosov, WB3AV.
Plum Brook in Ohio, or one in a smaller one in by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You know, stick a container in there. Close the container, bring it out, and open it up. And it might be a little tough to open because there'll be a vacuum in there. But, you know, once you get it open, you're not going to smell anything. Any air that's around is going to be sucked right into the container. It's a good story. Anyway, any comments? I got one or two more here.
Yeah, Paul.
Yeah, go ahead. Somebody said Paul. Is that Roy or somebody? Whoever said that.
I think it was me. And you also wanted to say something.
Definitely fire in a vacuum. The gunpowder, both the modern smokeless powder and the original black powder, include oxidizers. You do not need outside air.
Okay, there you go. And thank you for that. And Roy, over to you.
Yeah, Paul, I just want to mention that usually you want aromatic compounds to be carried by air. Not 100% necessary. If someone sprays some kind of aromatic compound at you in a vacuum right before you die, you might perceive some odor. You might not. It's not a healthy experiment either way. Getting back for a second, Bereshit, that basically means in the beginning. So it's the first three words of the book of Genesis. So they didn't really travel very far for another word for the project. They went from the first three words of Genesis to the title, Genesis.
Okay, well, Genesis is easier for me to remember. I think they're running out of names. There was Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 on the, at Bigelow. Bigelow wanted to build these inflatable space stations, and he actually launched two vehicles, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and they were unmanned, but they're still in orbit, and they're still operating. There's solar panels that can send back telemetry, and they inflated, and then he went beyond that, and he put the NASA sent one up and attached it to the space station. It's still attached to the space station, and it's called the Beam, B-E-A-M, the Bigelow Excursion Activity Mount Module. So it's an inflatable room attached to the space station. But getting back to Genesis, they had another one, a vehicle that went out to an asteroid and brought back molecules. Actually crash landed in the Utah desert, and that was called Genesis. So they have these, they're starting to duplicate the names. And by the way, the Beam module that's inflated, they're using that for storage on the space station. They were supposed to disconnect that a couple of years ago. It was going to attach for 2 years, and they were going to disconnect it, but it worked so good that they're leaving it attached. And they have these HEPA filters in there, charcoal HEPA filters, drop it. And they took these filters and they installed them into one of the modules called Unity on the space station. Unity was one of the first modules to be put up into the part of a space station, and air filtration system going on in Unity, and they install four of these things, and they think that the charcoal HEPA filters and HEF, they have the same idea of what everybody's going to be putting in for this COVID stuff here on Earth, to be able to take viruses out. Well, it also theoretically could take out benzene from the air. So they put four of them into Unity, and that they think that'll help. Well, they'll find out once they get their air quality meter from the Progress launch later on this month. Okay, I just want to talk about Brookhaven National Lab for a second. I'm right here on Long Island. There was an article that came out about this radio telescope that they're building in Brookhaven Lab. They're building it not so much to, it's a small, relatively small, although it looks pretty big on the kept of it. Scientists are, what they want to do is they want to calibrate this. They want to fine-tune it. They want to be able to have it look at the sky and look at the hydrogen frequencies. I think it's 1.4 or so gigahertz. And they want to be able to make sure that, if there's other signals, either from satellites or from other nearby somewhere, that it doesn't interfere or become part of that signal. when they're looking into space, using it for radio astronomy. So what they want to do is the whole idea of this particular antenna setup is to test it, and they take a drone and they send a signal, a very light small signal from the drone. They fly it over the antenna and like a zigzag pattern, and they have GPS on the drone, and they can tell it, they know exactly where the drone is, but they want to see if that signal comes up and they're able to receive that on this antenna. This antenna looks like it's got four horns looking down at these reflecting dishes. And they're trying to see if they can pick it up and see, you know, see what it's like. And different frequencies and you know, harmonics of different frequencies. They want to be able to eliminate that. This way, when they see something like that, they'll know to deduct that from the signal, the original signal. For instance, a satellite going overhead. You could easily hear a satellite going overhead. With an HT. But they want to, there's different harmonics that are coming off that. And they want to see if, the lowest harmonics that are coming off the satellite is going to be picked up by these radio astronomy antennas, especially when they start making them bigger. They're talking about making them 1,000 times bigger than what they have here. And they're using this drone to calibrate it. So I thought it was interesting that it's going out here on Brookhaven Lab. And some of the things that get accomplished here are not too far from us, like the launch accomplished company in Brooklyn, and now calibrating our radio astronomy antennas to make them more sensitive here in Brookhaven, our national lab out here in Suffolk County. Any questions or comments? WS to us. Okay, nothing heard. Just a quick update on the X-37B project. X-37B is a vehicle that gets launched into space inside of a fairing on top of a rocket. It's gone up so far on an Atlas V rocket by NASA, by a United Launch Alliance rover to Mars, and also the same rocket that will eventually launch Starliner with four people to the International Space Station. That's all going to happen next year. With the crew going up on Starliner. That's also, they've also launched the X-37B on a SpaceX Falcon 9 vehicle as well. And I think this is around a sixth flight, and they're in orbit now. And eventually when it comes back down, it lands on a runway in Florida. The earlier flights, they landed them out in Edwards Air Force Base in California, but now they actually land back in Florida. They have two of these things. One will go up for about a couple of years, and then the other one will go up for a couple of years. One comes down, the other one goes up. And on this flight, it's a basically a spy vehicle. It's put up by the military. But the last couple of flights, they are taking up experiments, like for NASA or something. And in this one, they took up an experiment for the Navy Research Facility in Virginia. What it is a preliminary proof of concept test to be able to take solar light and convert it into microwave. And the ultimate goal would be to send it down, beam it down to Earth, but right now it's just taking that, converting it. think they're getting into the gigahertz range, and they're sending it down on a coax to a receiver on the same vehicle. They just want to see the results, and they can extrapolate from the results and try to get the percentage of, you know, what percentage of solar light is coming in compared to the amount of power that would be sent out. And we talked about the sun and net when it did launch a while back, but now they actually have the test results back from doing this. And apparently they like the numbers, they like the results. Ultimate goal would be to either use it, you know, for space and beam it down to Earth, or maybe you could take solar power and beam it to from mountain to mountain. You know, if you have a military group, you know, on another mountain, and you need to get them extra power for any reason, you don't need to send a generator. You can just beam it to them, that type of thing. But it was a successful test, proof of concept. And that's pretty much all I have here. So, you know, if anybody has any comments or questions before we turn it back to Roy, let me know. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report of the TechNet. Okay, that's okay. We'll turn it over to Roy. And I don't know if you got that email, Roy, that I sent you. But, you know, if you put that on your website, that would be good. It's always good to review these things first. But this one had absolutely no advertisement, no commercials. It was pretty good. AC2GS, this is WS2N. Back to you.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Paul. And, yeah, I saw it. I posted it on the website. I posted a few links that Wesley sent me. Very nice YouTube video of a scientist working on quantum computers, trying to explain to people how it works. There's a longer video that is available if you like the first one, and another YouTube, I think, that about how lithium-ion batteries work that Wesley sent me. So you can get to them all going through roy.ac2gs.com. That's the link page. A little bit addition, HEPA filters are pretty much by definition for large particle filters. They filter something like, well, there's two standards. There's the European standard and there's an American standard. The European is not that great. Yeah, that filters about 85% of particulates over about 300 microns. This is it 0.3 microns? I think it's 0.3 microns. The American standard is 99.7 or something, so a lot better. But you have to understand, benzene is a molecule. It's about 1.4 angstroms in diameter. That's a thousandth of the size of any filter can filter. So you need something like activated charcoal with a high surface area that absorbs the organic compounds into its surface. Let me drop for a sec.
They have charcoal. They said these things were charcoal.
Yeah, the activated charcoal is an addition, really, to a HEPA filter. If you buy a standard HEPA filter, it's only doing filtration. A lot of commercial HEPA filters will include the option of putting extra filtration systems above and beyond the HEPA filter. And a lot of times it's activated carbon. So, yeah, it's the activated carbon that pretty much soaks up the organic molecule.
Complete. Good. Well, maybe this will work. You know, they might run a test and find out it's gone.
I hope so. I hope it ends up being just one of those wacky stories that gets written up, like the hole that someone drilled in part of the spacecraft and isn't fessing up to it.
Yeah, I know that came out of Russia. It was their craft, wasn't ours. That's ridiculous. But I just think somebody was installing something and they said, oh, we'll put it here, and somebody said drill there, and they kept going.
Yeah, on Earth they give these people something called the Darwin Prize. Usually every so often there's some poor schlep who has decided that he's going to hacksaw his gas pipe without cutting the gas line.
You know, all right, let me tell you one quick story. We got time. We used to install these pipes, you know, they were either 1 inch or 3/4 for heating systems in these apartment buildings, you know, these apartment buildings with, you know, some of them were either 6 or 8 stories high, or, you know, and you have these, the joists going along on the floor, wood joists, and the system was, you know, you would notch these, filter these beams, these wooden joists, and, you know, cut them maybe an inch and a half or, you know, maybe 2 inches down, and it was all accepted by the engineers. That's what you would do. And, you know, you would take two cuts, maybe an inch and a half down, and you would hit with a hammer, and they would come out. And you would be able to install these pipes. Essentially, they'd be under the floor, and it would pop up, and it would eventually connect to your heater. So, you know, maybe get an idea. They were called branches. You know, so they had this, the one apprentice, he said, notch these things, we got to install these, it was notches. They came back an hour later, and he had cut through a couple of the beams, actually through the beams, you know, I mean, right through, you know, and naturally a major problem. But that's probably what happened there, you know. Tell some new guy, just drill a hole in, and it was a 10 millimeter hole, and we're going to attach a, you know, a fixture here or something inside the spacecraft, and the guy probably drilled through it. Hope nobody saw this. And, you know, it had to be something like that, Roy. Back to you.
Yeah, I just don't understand why they can't fess up to it. Why? I guess if you don't tell anyone anything, then why should you tell them about this? But I don't quite understand Russian.
Don't admit to anything. That's it.
Well, there's more than a few people in the United States that live by that creed.
I concur. A couple of famous people. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, this has been the Limar Technical Net. I am still AC2GS, Roy. And I want to thank everyone, as usual, who participated tonight, who made it a lively conversation. And I also appreciate the people that send me emails and suggestions and cite articles and give me ideas that I can present to the people here. And we can, you know, smack it around and see what we learn, discover, or come up with. So I, again, thank everyone who participated in one way or the other. You know, it's you guys that make the net, not me. I'm just the guy at the front kind of coordinating everything. So I do appreciate it. Once again, I want to remind everyone that if you have any topics that you would like covered, if you have any questions you would like answered, you can't get onto the radio, or if you have a puzzle that you'd like to share with me, or you'd like me to pass on some information to Paul. The email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links to all the article that Paul cited, some articles that Wesley sent me, and a few interesting articles, including the Ude Space article, is available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, the archives are available on my KC2NJI's website, amateurradio.tv. Go back to September of 2006. And here's a bit of wisdom from one of the wisest men that I've known, Dick K2RIW, and that is simply be kind to each other. A few words, but they mean a great deal. And once again, everyone, be safe. We live in dangerous times. Thankfully, New York State is not going to get the brunt of this next wave, but people down south are, unfortunately, and our hopes and wishes and blessings and prayers and everything go down to them, and we hope this passes rather quickly and relatively benignly. But be safe. Don't be frightened. Don't be fear. Fear is the mind killer, as the book said. Just be intelligent about the whole thing. So this is AC2GS, and we'll be back next Sunday to do this all over again. Have a safe week. Until then, arrivederci.